Thank you very much, Anthony, and good evening, everyone. It's a real pleasure on behalf of the Board of the Reserve Bank to be able to welcome you all to this fantastic location on a beautiful Melbourne evening. So welcome. I want to particularly welcome the Treasurer of Victoria, the Honourable Tim Pallas, who's representing the Premier tonight. The Premier sent his apologies. He unfortunately had another obligation. I'd also like to welcome the Honourable Michael O'Brien, the Shadow Treasurer for Victoria, and also Adam Bandt, the member for the federal seat of Melbourne. And Adam's also a member of the House of Representatives Economics Committee, which has parliamentary oversight of the bank and before which my colleagues and I appear twice a year to answer their questions for 3 hours in front of the TV cameras. It's also really pleasing for us to have leaders here from the worlds of politics, academia, the community sector, as well as business. Having leaders join us from right across the community is really important to us because the decisions that our board take and that the Reserve Bank takes affect all Australians. There's price stability, financial stability, sustainable growth, strong employment, a well-functioning payment system. They matter to all of us, and really together each of these things are important to our collective prosperity. So thank you for your interest in the Reserve Bank and thank you for being here tonight. This is the first of these dinners that I've had the pleasure of hosting. A particular privilege is to be able to do it in Melbourne, where we had our board meeting today in our offices on the corner of Exhibition and Collins Street. 4 of our 9 board members are now based in Melbourne. Carol Schwartz recently joined Kath Tanner, Catherine Fagg, and Ian Harper on the Reserve Bank board. You actually have to wind the clock back 30 years to find another time when we had 4 residents of Melbourne on the Reserve Bank board. So it's particularly given the high representation of Melbourne on our board at the moment, it's great to be here, and all members of the Reserve Bank board are here tonight. And I'd also like to welcome Kathy Walter, who's a member of the Payment System Board. We have 3 former board members of the Reserve Bank here tonight as well, Hugh Morgan, Graham Cray and Joe Gersh. So welcome to you all. At our meeting today, the board decided to keep the cash rate unchanged at 1.5%. I don't think that came as a surprise to many people. And as usual, the reasons for that decision was set out in our statement issued at 2:30, just shortly after our meeting. And I don't want to run through all the issues that the board considered here tonight, but there are 2 that I want to talk about. And they are the improvement in the global economy, and the second is household debt and the housing market. Over recent months, businesses and consumer sentiment have lifted in many countries around the world, and global trade and industrial production are picking up. Commodity prices are also quite a lot higher than they were for most of last year. Headline inflation rates have increased, largely due to higher oil prices. And it's good news that we've passed the point of maximum monetary stimulus in the global economy. Given all this, at the G20 meetings that the Federal Treasurer and I attended in Baden-Baden in Germany a couple of weeks ago, the tone was much more positive than it had been in previous meetings of the G20. And reflecting that, in the last few months, we've seen successive upward revisions to forecasts for world growth. And that's quite in contrast to the experience of the last 4 or 5 years, when every time there'd be a new revision for the forecast, they'd be lower. So I think the worst has passed in the global economy is looking quite a lot better. And so we're in a much better position than we were this time last year. There are, of course, still some serious clouds on the horizon. One that dominated discussions at the G20 meetings was the possible retreat from an open, rules-based international trading system. If this were to occur, it would be clearly bad for the global economy. It would be very bad for us here in Australia. The positive aspect, though, of these discussions is that they've generated a renewed commitment or interest in quite a lot of countries, including many emerging market economies, interest or focus on the importance of an open international trading system. So those countries, which had previously not been particularly strong advocates of that type of system, are now speaking up vocally and frequently about the importance of that. And so we in Australia have a particularly, we have a lot riding on this open system being maintained. The improvement in the global economy is helping us in Australia. Commodity prices are up. There's been some improvement in business sentiment as well. And investment outside the resources sector is now starting to lift after having been very weak for a long period of time. So that's all positive news. The labour market, though, remains pretty soft. Growth in employment slow, and wage growth has been the lowest that it has been in some decades. And we will want to see an improvement here before we can be confident that growth in the overall economy is strengthening. We'll also need to assess the effects on the economy from the damage from the cyclone Debbie in Queensland and the floods in northern New South Wales. Well, that's too early to make a full assessment of those effects. The second issue that I want to talk about is household borrowing and the housing market. This is something the board discussed extensively at its meeting today, and we've been discussing for some time. As the level of household debt in Australia is high, and it is rising. Over the past year, the value of housing-related debt owed in the country increased by 6.5%. The value of the growth rate in household income was 3%. So debt's rising at 6.5%, and our incomes are rising at 3%. And the result of all that is a further rise in the ratio of household debt to our income, and it was already at a high level. In aggregate, households are coping pretty well with the higher levels of debt. Arrears rates remain pretty low. Many households have also built up sizable buffers in mortgage offset accounts. But at the same time, the slow wage growth is making it harder for many households to pay down their debt. And for many people, this combination of high levels of debt and slow wage growth is turning out to be quite a sobering combination. In the housing market, conditions continue to vary very significantly across the country. Here in Melbourne and in Sydney, prices are increasing briskly and the markets are strong. Contrast, in some other cities, conditions are quite subdued. And in some cities, most noticeably Perth, prices are actually declining at the moment. And growth in rents nationally is the lowest that it's been in some decades. So putting it all together, it's quite a complex picture, and there isn't a single story that applies right across our country. But as is often the case in economics, it largely comes down to supply and demand. On the demand side, population growth in Australia, especially in our larger cities, picked up in the middle of the 2000s. And it's really only in the last couple of years that the rate of growth of home building has picked up to match the stronger population growth. And this resulting imbalance has been compounded by insufficient investment in transport infrastructure that's needed to support the growing population. As nothing increases the supply of well-located land and thus well-located housing like good transport links. Underinvestment in this area is one of the factors that has pushed up housing prices. And put simply, the supply side has not adjusted to the stronger demand side. Not surprisingly, the result is higher prices. Also not surprisingly, the higher prices have encouraged people to buy residential properties and investment in the hope of ongoing capital gains. With interest rates as low as they've been right around the world, investors have found it attractive to go to the bank and borrow money to invest in appreciating residential property. And it's clear that this borrowing has reinforced the upward pressure on prices. Now, this configuration of increases in indebtedness and rising house prices has been discussed at length at the Council of Financial Regulators. This council, which I chair, brings together the heads of the Reserve Bank, APRA, ASIC and the Australian Treasury. The concern has been, The concern has not been that developments in the housing market pose a risk to the stability of our financial institutions. Our banks are resilient and they're soundly capitalised. Instead, the concern has been that the longer the recent trends continued, the greater the risk to the future health of our economy. A strong lesson from history is that stretched balance sheets make for more volatile times when things turn down. And given this, over the past couple of years, there's been a concerted effort by APRA to encourage lenders to strengthen their lending standards. And this followed a deterioration in these lending standards a few years ago. So at the end of 2014, when growth in investor lending was accelerating, APRA announced that it would pay very close attention to lenders whose investor loan portfolios were growing faster than 10%. And it did this with the full support of the RBA. This guidance did help pull the whole system back, and it has made a positive contribution to overall financial stability. And so too has ASIC's focus on responsible lending. These measures constrain some high-risk lending in the system and reinforce the message to financial institutions that they do need to take a systemic focus or a system-wide focus in their risk assessments. And notwithstanding all that, given recent trends and the heightened risk environment, APRA announced some further measures last Friday, and again it did this with the full support of the Council of Financial Regulators. There are two parts of APRA's announcement that I want to draw your attention to. The first is the need for lenders to have a very strong focus on serviceability. Despite the focus in this area over recent times, too many loans are still being made where the borrower has the skinniest of income buffers after interest payments. In some cases, lenders are assuming that people can live more frugally than in practice they can, and that's leaving the borrowers with very little buffer if things go wrong, as they sometimes do. So APRA quite rightly said that lenders can expect a very strong supervisory focus from it on loans with a very low net income surplus. The second area I want to touch on is interest-only lending. Over the past year, close to 40% of housing loans in Australia have been made have not required the scheduled repayment of even $1 of principal. Only interest payments are required. This is quite unusual by international standards. In some countries, repayment of at least some principal is required on every single housing loan. In other countries, interest-only housing loans are available only if the borrower has already made a substantial down payment. So this is one area where Australia stands out. We're certainly not unique, but we are unusual. There are a couple of factors that have contributed to the popularity of interest-only loans in Australia. One's the flexibility of Australian mortgages. Many people with interest-only loans make significant payments into mortgage offset accounts rather than explicitly paying down the principal. And this flexibility is of quite a lot of value to many borrowers, and that flexibility isn't there in many other countries. A second factor that's important is the taxation arrangements that apply to investments in residential property. Last week, APRA stated that it expected that new interest-only loans should account for no more than 30% of the flow of new loans. It also stated that institutions should place very strict limits on interest-only loans with high loan-to-value ratios. Like the earlier speed limits on investor lending, these new requirements should help the whole system pull back to a more sustainable position. A reduced reliance on interest-only loans in Australia would be a positive development, and it would help improve the resilience of our system. And with interest rates so low, now is a good time for us to be moving in this direction. Hopefully, the changes might also encourage a few more people to think about the merit of taking out very large interest-only loans when interest rates are near their historic lows. So the RBA welcomes these latest changes. It's important, though, we be realistic about what these and other prudential measures can achieve. As I said before, the underlying driver in the housing market is the balance between supply and demand. The availability of credit is undoubtedly a factor that can amplify demand, but it's not the root cause. I think this assessment is consistent with the observation that the housing market dynamics across the country vary significantly, despite Australia having nationwide financial institutions and a common interest rate that applies across the country. I find it hard to escape the conclusion that we need to address the supply side if we are to avoid ever rising housing costs relative to our incomes and to avoid the intended incentive to borrow that's created by rising asset prices. The various prudential measures do not address the underlying supply-demand issues, but they can reduce the risk from the financial side of the housing market while the underlying issues are addressed, and they are gradually being addressed. The prudential measures help lessen the amplification of the cycle that we get from borrowing, and they reduce the risk of developments on the financial side, weakening the resilience of our system, which we have relied on over recent times. Now, ideally, this could all be achieved by financial institutions acting themselves without the need for any prudential guidance. But as it turns out, sometimes prudential guidance can help the whole system adjust, and I think that's what's happening here. The calibration of this guidance is not precise, it's not straightforward, so we do need to keep the matters under review. The Council of Financial Regulators will continue to assess how the system responds to these various measures, and it would consider further measures if they were needed. As I said, though, in the end, addressing the supply side of the housing market is likely to prove a more durable way of dealing with the concerns, the legitimate concerns that people have about debt and housing prices than is detailed supervisory guidance. So it's all about supply, and progress is being made here including in Melbourne, but there more needs to be done. So that's enough on debt and housing. I apologise, it's not a particularly good topic for dinner. I do, though, before finishing, want to recognise that tomorrow we're having the official opening of our new banknote distribution centre out at Craigieburn in outer Melbourne. This new centre is an important investment for us in Victoria. It will help us manage the task of issuing and storing banknotes nationally for many years to come. The new facility is being built around a mega vault, and as you can imagine, it's a highly secure facility. It uses the latest technology, and it's our first major investment in banknote storage and distribution for decades. As I hope you're also aware, we're currently in the process of upgrading our banknotes to stay ahead of counterfeiters. Counterfeiting rates in Australia are still low, but they are creeping up. The new $5 note came out in September last year, and the public reaction to it has been favourable. At the bank, we're very proud of that note, not just because of the design of it, but because of the embedded security features, which are world-leading. And the new $10 note we released in September. We're busy printing those at the moment. And the $50 note will be released next year. As you can imagine, issuing a new series of banknotes is a major logistical exercise. There are currently 1.5 billion individual banknotes on issue in Australia. That averages 62 per person. We often wonder where they all are. We also hold very, very large contingency stocks, which we needed during the financial crisis when the demand for banknotes surged to an unprecedented rate. It might come as a surprise to you to learn that despite all the talk of a cashless society, all the talk of electronic payments, the value of banknotes on issue in Australia today relative to GDP is the highest that it's been in 50 years. Australians have come to rely on our secure and high-quality banknotes, and a new state-of-the-art facility at Craigieburn will help us manage the storage and distribution of these notes around the country for many years to come. So again, thank you for coming this evening. Thank you for your interest in the important work that the Reserve Bank does for the community. I hope you enjoy your dinner and enjoy the conversation. Thank you.